We are extremely happy to welcome Billy Cobham to the World Cafe today. His influence on drummers, period, on the whole concept of what fusion is, on what playing together in a number of just amazing ensembles has been incredible over the years. When you speak of your fusion drumming, you got to mention the band Dreams that you were in before you started playing with Miles Davis, the Jack Johnson album, Bitches Brew, of which I understand I looked. You're not credited on, or
no.
And then from that, working with John McLaughlin with Mahavishnu Orchestra, mm-hmm. which is unbelievable.
It's really funny when you mention Bitches Brew. Quite honestly, all I remember, because I was more of like a fly on the wall for a lot of the stuff that we did within those sessions. I remember seeing everybody else do something. I don't remember doing anything except for one record date which was an aberration. It was kind of one of those things where we were rehearsing at Miles's house and I didn't know what we were doing. We end up in the studio and we start to get a sound check in essence. Mm. And Miles had said, don't play in between takes. And of course, John McLaughlin being Peck's bad boy, you know, it took a little bit of time. We're waiting, and then all of a sudden John started to get this groove. The next thing you know, it started to develop. And Michael Henderson started playing a little bit, and it was just like, there's something to do, and, you know, what's going on? There was nothing happening in the control room, so it was like, just try it. Probably don't have anything up. Next thing you know, I'm playing. Because now it's really infectious. And there's not much else we could do. So we're playing. Miles comes out and said, I told you not to play in between takes. Stop. Okay. Next thing you know, John's got this groove again. And this happened, I think, three times. And the third time, it was so infectious that Miles came outside and said, red button. And the light went on. And we recorded the shuffle. And then years later, because I remembered that, there was this package that came out. And it has me credited in the package of the Bitches Brew Sessions. And I'm going, okay. whatever blows your whistle, man. It's okay. Whatever.
Well, they were probably figuring you were in the room and they better credit you or, you know, in case you did something.
I guess so, just in case.
I kind of wanted to talk about some of these transitions between this music, the transition from that, and I'm curious as to your relationship with John moving into Mahavishnu Orchestra, John mm-hmm. McLaughlin, and then the transition out of that, which leads to Spectrum, which is the album of the moment, is you're out on this mm-hmm. 40th anniversary. I'm sorry, I find it hard to believe, anniversary
tour. Isn't
it
something?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I've been listening back to the album. I didn't pull out my vinyl because I would love to hear what it sounds like mm-hmm. on vinyl again. Mm-hmm. And I just say this, you know, this is fresh. This is fresh. Can we kind of talk a little bit about the transition into working with you know, Jan Hammer and John McLaughlin and everybody and Jerry Goodman, who's out on the Spectrum tour?
Yeah.
In Mahavishnu Orchestra, was there any discussion while you were working with John or not working with John on Bitches Brew?
I was working with John and Miles, and he was getting the idea that he wanted to do something on his own, I guess, at that point. And so we used to play in duet together just to get the feel for what we were doing. Out of that came My Goals Beyond with Charlie Hayden. And then that's where I met Jerry Goodman. And from there, continual practice with Jerry and John. Then came Jan Hammer, who was at the time on the road with Sarah Vaughan, I think. And Wick Laird was tapped to join us, but he was en route from, I think it was Australia. He was actually about to move to Australia and got a phone call on a boat. On, wow. Had to turn around and come back. Long trip. So, of course, he was late. and we all berated him for being late on the boat.
That's funny. You've talked a bit about the social dynamics of the band and how it changed over the years.
Yeah.
The Mahavish New Orchestra. And I would think that would be, particularly with a band like that, where you, there's space for everybody, but it is such, the communication has to be so incredibly tight. How much does the social dynamic of the band affect the music? It's kind of a, I know, a bit of a naive question. But
I don't think so. It's a question, not naive as much as it is a question that is not asked enough and not looked into enough. But I believe from the musician standpoint, we have to have a working positive relationship on stage. And that working positive relationship has to transcend anything that happens off stage, even though what happens off stage affects what we do on stage. The strange thing is with that band mindset, you know, this is where the negatives become the positives because that's all we have to draw on. But we have we have five highly, in my opinion, insecure individuals who are trying to measure up to the level of proficiency of one person. Who is the leader of the band? This is the theological, philosophical aspect of being a bit fragmented searchers. One person is following a guru, so another guy goes, maybe that's the right way to go, so he gets one, but it's not the same guru. And then another guy doesn't go as far as getting a guru, but body language tends to lean in that direction. And then there are two other guys who are completely opposite of that are going, are you people crazy or what? Just by the body language, you know. And no, I'm not going to do it, you know. But at the same time, leaning in that direction by playing the music as well as they did because they really respected, they loved the music that they were playing. It was very interesting. It gave them a chance to present their personality in a way that they otherwise would not be able to do. So with that being said, out of the negative came a lot of positive, but it was only going to be short term.
Right. Mm-hmm. We're talking with Billy Cobham about his career, and specifically right now about the Mahavish New Orchestra. I put on Spectrum and... of course, the first thing that hits you is Quadrant 4, which is the piece with Tommy Bolin. And it's just, I mean, I guess the whole album is with Tommy, but that's a real showcase for him. Can you tell a little bit about how you envisioned this piece and Tommy's role in it?
Well, first and foremost, a lot of people misunderstand. A lot of the guitar solos on that record, it's Jan.
Wait a minute. It's Jan. It's a keyboard that sounds
like Jan playing minimo.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Tommy does have the main solo in the middle, but the opening solo is not Tommy. It's Jan.
Uh-huh.
And everybody thinks it's Tommy. And that's
me.
How Tommy got the gig with Deep Purple.
Oh, that is
great
funny.
Story. But that was a tune that I wanted to just get. I'll say, okay, here's your Mahavishnu tune. We'll do this fast shuffle. So we played a blues that I'd written. And after that, it was open season for everything else. You know, I wanted to go in a completely different direction, you know. And so everything slowed down from there. Odd tempo thing, we did the Spectrum. But Quadrant 4 fundamentally was just a nice way to go, yeah, this is where it is. Let's get it done. And now we move on to something else called Billy Cobham. Yeah.
This is Quadrant 4. Quadrant 4, which is the way that the album Spectrum began in 1973 and still does today. And we're talking with Billy Cobham, who's out with Spectrum 40, a tour that includes Jerry Goodman from Mahavishnu Orchestra. There was a lot of technology that went into the sound of a lot of records. We were just talking about the fact that the what everybody thinks, or myself included, was the guitar solo was Jan Hammer. Mm-hmm. As a drummer, how did you embrace technology and how did it affect you?
Tremendously. There was a point where I was traveling with Robert Bob Moog, System 55 patchable synthesizer on the road in road cases. And I felt like I understood what Keith Emerson would go through, you know, to set that stuff up. Because it was, at that time, you were getting less than maybe 34 kilobytes coming out of the thing, and you never knew for sure if it was going to be in tune, you know. And this was a mini, this was the baby brother of Tano's expanding headband, you know. So it, they would take hours to put that thing together. But I loved it. It was great.
How early did you embrace electronic drums?
1968.
Wow.
Miazzi. Drums, out of Italy, out of Milano. It was me and Jack DeJeanette, Max Roach, three or four of us, I'm pretty sure. And we started fooling around with it then.
And I sort of mentioned technological advances affecting music. And, of course, sampling, we can put that in there as well. And one of the... A number of the patterns on Spectrum have been used, and most famously, of course, Stratus was turned into Blue Lines by Massive Attack.
Yes.
And how was that back before people had to tell you they were doing it, or how did you find out about that? And
well, it was a situation where actually Michael Jackson. My brother was working for Michael Jackson at Larrabee. I think he was doing History at the time. Mm-hmm. And my brother was a technician for him. And in the studio, Michael came in and told him that he had heard my tune being played in another studio in the building. And it sounded really great. And he wondered if I was there, but he would have known. Who was doing it, and asked Wayne to check it out. And Wayne was so busy, because I think Teddy Riley was producing Michael at the time. So Wayne had his hands full getting all the things he needed to get done for Michael. So a few days went by, Michael asked him again, and this time it was more forcefully, I guess, because he got Wayne off his duff and he went over to find out what was going on. He walked in, it sounded really good. At the very end, he said, "Man, you guys sound great, and you should, you know, does Billy Cobham know about this?" And they all turned around to him, and somebody out of, I guess, management said, "Well, who are you?" And he said, "I'm Billy's brother. I'm working with Michael next door, and just wondered if you had spoken to any of the right people." And apparently, that was the cue. And that's how that one went. And so we all took part in enjoying the spoils of that one, that
good.
Particular venture. Thank you.
Good, because there were so many who did not. So
that, yes, that's exactly right.
That's Well, let's listen to where where what they took came from. This is a Stratus from the Spectrum album celebrating its 40th anniversary. And we're talking with Billy Cobham today on the World Cafe. We'll be right back. That is Stratus, an amazing piece of music. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think I've heard you say that you felt that was the centerpiece of the album, or other people have said that, that's for sure. How did you feel about the piece Stratus at the time?
It was one of the compositions that I wrote. I was at a very, very, very primal, or I should say primitive stage of writing. All I knew was, it was like learning how to write, to type on a manual typewriter with two fingers, you know, because I needed to get it done. I had an idea, I needed to just do it. And I didn't have time to go to school or read the manual, you know. So, yes, I went to the conservatory and all of that, you know, music and art high school and all of that, the Army. But it was still about me just putting pen to paper, doing whatever I had to do to make things work.
And were you able to take the people who worked on the record to tour with
them? Yeah. No, not at all. I didn't know how. I had so little experience in dealing with the world in that way that I ended up making some tremendously big mistakes later on, because that record came out, say, around 73. And then I didn't go out on tour with the band, especially in Europe, until 74, 75. And by then, I still didn't have a strong administration in place, management and all of this. And that was the other edge of the sword, in a way. It was nice to have a good record and selling, but I didn't know how to manage it. It was like just one of those things where I just didn't know where to go. And that's another problem with artists, and that, you know, you know what's happening. You go to the things that you work with that at least you know, okay, there are mistakes here, but I can live with them. I can fix them, or I can do. It was not the answer. And I ended up making more mistakes on my own, and I take full responsibility for it. It's just the way it happened.
Billy Cobham is our guest today on The Cafe, and folks may or may not know, but your folks came to New York City from Panama, and when you were very young, and we talked a little bit about you're going to art school there, but you also lived in some great neighborhoods where there was a number of people from Latin American countries living.
Brooklyn, Bet-Sar.
Well, there you go. And you've mentioned that you think the Latin aspect of what you do has been important in your style and your career.
Absolutely. Yep. It's part and parcel of who I am and who I represent in terms of my my family base. You know, the whole aspect of Hispaniola, all of the area around the Caribbean is very, very, very important in its history, and it's highly rich. And so what I would hear, I would retain, because it was, they were getting me at a time when I was still molding inside mentally as a young person. So I would remember the patterns. I wouldn't identify by names, because nobody could tell. I did not speak Spanish in the Bed-Stuy environment for social reasons, and it tended to make the family more invisible if you spoke English. You sort of went along with the program. So to protect me, my folks did not speak Spanish in the house, so I didn't remember a lot of things. The sad part is now that I'm back in Panama, as a person that's 68 years old, here I am back in school, trying to get myself up to speed in the language, because it's very, very important to speak Spanish in Panama, and to be understanding of that environment and be sensitive to that environment as to how people live and work and function. So that said, going back to the music, I would play in that way. Whatever that was presented to me, it helped me a lot to learn how to phrase, if from a Hispanic position, a standpoint, as opposed to a North American standpoint, two different ways.
is sort of a technical drummer question. You play open-handed. What does that mean?
It means taking two shakers and giving them to my baby brother, and because I couldn't understand why anybody had to hold the stick in the left hand that kind of crossed over, and with the other hand open. And I thought, there's got to be a different way to do this to make it more fun for me to play, because I really want to play. What would happen if I did this and I turned the other stick over and I played them both open-handed? But then working with, I think it was Spex Powell or Styx Hooper, somebody like this, my father hooked me up with one of these teachers. They said, no, that's the wrong way to play. And I would say, why? And my father would say, because it's the wrong way to play. And I would go, oh, okay. And then when he wasn't looking, I'd go and sort of tinker with things just to see what would happen. And one of my tinkerings brought me to my brother, who was having a great time at the age of less than 1 year old, but approaching it with two rattlers, and he kept holding them in both hands. And I said, okay, hold these. Yeah. And I went, okay, I think I'm going to try this. And I started to just play match grip that way. And I found that it was really interesting to do it, because I had better control moving from right to left or left to right on the drum set. I also found that if I could control the reaction of the drumstick from the drum head with my fingers and not hold the drumsticks tightly, I found it to be much easier to play.
So kind of a lighter grip.
Well, there would be a grip where the stick actually had a fulcrum point, and it would bounce off of the index finger, and you would just let it bounce. And if you wanted to play faster, it was easier. If you wanted to play longer, it was no problem, because you weren't exerting as much energy. And these were things that I just developed over time, understanding the actual mechanics of playing in this particular way. And also watching very, very interesting individuals who played in the symphony, one being Vic Firth, who plays this way. It's called the French method. And another one by the name of Frederick Hinger, who played with the Metropolitan Opera, but he played in the Germanic way. So his sticks and his hands and his whole body became the music.
Mm.
Very emotional, very strong.
Do you play every day?
In my head.
Mm-hmm.
34/7, not 24/7, 34/7, 860 days a year.
What does that mean?
That you have to have an idea to force incorporate the body to do. The body is just a machine. The computer has to tell the machine what to do. The computer is the brain. So you have to play it first in the brain before you can play it through the body.
So are there any things with age that are different about your playing?
I play more spaces. I'm more thoughtful. I try to adjust to the negatives of age, which comes with hearing problems, being physically fit enough to do what I have to do, so I can play it in as an effective musical way as I can. And so that's where I am now. You know, sometimes I'm thinking I hear one thing when I don't, you know, I'm forcing myself to pay more attention to what I'm doing, because sometimes I'm playing maybe louder than I thought I was, or more aggressively than based on my deficiencies now as someone that's leaning in the sunrise years,
mm-hmm.
or so to say sunset years. And so in this way, I am trying to make those adjustments so that I can ultimately be more effective still, or be as effective as at all possible musically with my colleagues.
Well, I thought we would play another piece. I thought we'd play the title track of Spectrum as we go out. Billy Cobham, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, really.
And thank you for all your work over the years. We're talking about the first solo album, of which I'm staring at another 20 plus here in front of me. So there's so much to revisit. So you'll have to do a Crosswinds tour next time. So
I'd love to.
We'll work through it that way.
Yeah.
This is Spectrum. Title track of Spectrum, our guest Billy Cobham today on the World Cafe.